Blog Talk Radio.
Take a licking. There is someone waiting who will hurry up and rescue you. Just call
Welcome to the Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer Radio Show, brought to you by Tractor Supply, where we give away more chicken coops and chicken-related prizes than anyone else on the planet. We are often imitated, but never duplicated. My name is Andy Schneider, but most know me as the Chicken Whisperer, author of The Chicken Whisperer's Guide to Keeping Chickens, and national spokesperson for the USDA Biosecurity for Birds program. Today is Thursday, May 9th, and I would like to thank all of you for tuning in this afternoon on Blog Talk Radio. This is a live radio show that is broadcast around the world. This radio show is all about keeping backyard poultry, show poultry, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Each week, I welcome experts in their field to share their knowledge about different topics, including backyard poultry, show poultry, heritage poultry, gardening, cooking, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Be sure to visit our website, chickenwhisperer.com, where you can follow us on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook. Once again, I would like to thank all of you for tuning in to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by Tractor Supply. Ware Manufacturing has been building quality hutches since 1983. Ware manufactures modern chicken hutches, barns, pens, and nest boxes designed especially for the backyard flock. Ware offers hutches and pens for every yard size and every chicken keeper's budget. Visit their website at waremfginc.com. That's waremfginc.com. Or call them to find a retailer near you at 1-888-824-7257. Ware Manufacturing. And you can find all the great Ware products here. Critter-Cages.com is your one-stop shop for all your critters' housing needs. They stock a wide selection of supplies and equipment for rabbits, guinea pigs, hamsters, mice, rats, ferrets, chinchillas, chickens, and other small critters. Their chicken selection includes chicken barns, chicken coops, and chicken yards from top manufacturers. Your critters will love their selection of quality products, and you'll love their low prices. Visit them online at critter-cages.com. That's critter-cages.com. Introducing the Chicken Fountain, a new way to water your flock. The Chicken Fountain will change your life and keep your chickens healthier by providing clean, fresh water every time. No more daily cleaning of dirty chicken waterers. This semi-sealed system keeps every drop of water fresh and clean. Proudly made in the USA, the Chicken Fountain will provide your flock with fresh, clean water for years to come. To order your Chicken Fountain, visit chickenfountain.com. That's chickenfountain.com. Hey, it's the Chicken Whisperer. If you're in the market for a new incubator, then look no further than GQF. They have a great selection of tabletop and cabinet-style incubators at prices you can afford. I love my GQF Genesis Model 1588. It has a large picture window and an automatic thermostat, which makes for a better hatch every time. Go pick out your new incubator at GQFradio.com. That's GQFradio.com.
Hi, I'm country music artist Nathan Osmond, and you're listening to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. We've got a special episode today since there was no show on Monday. We've got Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor. He'll be joining us here in just a few minutes, and he's going to be talking all about coccidiosis and CRD, chronic respiratory disease, in chickens. He picked out those two topics because there's a lot of buzz right now over on Facebook specifically for those two diseases, so he thought that he would talk a little bit about that today. We have had shows in the past on both of those full two-hour shows in detail, so you can listen to those on our archive at blogtalkradio.com or, iTunes.com, podcast.com, Zoom.com. We're out there everywhere, and so you can take a listen to those previous episodes a little bit more in detail. Thanks for all the emails and the well wishes. Lily is doing very, very well. She had some surgery on her ear on Monday, and she just had a little... on the very top of her ear, where a lot of girls get their ears pierced up in the cartilage part, I guess, there was a collection of fluid between the skin and the cartilage. And we had it drained, I guess, last Thursday, and they knew it would refill back up without the surgery, but they scheduled surgery for Monday morning. We had it drained again on Saturday, and then they performed the procedure on Monday, which drained it and then actually packed it and stitched it with some gauze to keep it compressed, almost like a stitched-in compression dressing, to keep it from refilling and let that skin reattach to the cartilage. So we'll go, I guess, on Wednesday, next Wednesday, and we'll have all those sutures removed, and she should be as good as new. But she's a trooper, and she's doing very, very good. So thank you for all the well wishes via the email. She's doing very well. Thank you very much. So hope your gardens are doing well. Of course, we got our garden in, and it's going great. We've gotten plenty of rain, and we're getting plenty of sun now. The night temperatures are starting to hold a little bit higher. So things should start sprouting here in the next few days. We put out a lot of stuff, not quite as big as we have in the past. We didn't plant the full acre this year, but I'd say we probably have a good half acre planted, I would think. And we've got corn, and which we did. We got about 10 rows of corn. Then we got tomato plants in. We did probably about eight tomato plants. I'm looking for four more. I'm looking for four Brandywines, a great heirloom tomato, which Jen loves. But I think I put in a couple of Rutgers and a couple of, I think they're called beefsteaks and a couple of bigger boy, better boy, things like that. And then we're looking for four heirloom. We found them last year here locally, and hopefully we'll find them again. They may come in a little bit later, but they're called Brandywines, and they are fabulous. We planted them for years, and so I'm looking for four more of those, and that'll give us 12 tomato plants. And then a real long, long row of butter beans, long row of snap beans, green beans, string beans, whatever you want to call it, depending on where you're from. We put in a row of zipper peas, a row of purple hole peas. We did two rows of okra, and then we came in and we did, I think, about eight cucumber. Eight peppers. We got yellow bell pepper, green bell pepper, red bell pepper. We did about eight squash, and then we did probably... I bet we did eight cantaloupe, eight watermelon, and we probably did about 10 or 12 pumpkin. So, they should start coming up. I was down in the garden actually a little bit this morning. We've got the potatoes and the onions that we planted back in February, and they are pretty much ready to harvest any day now, and any day and every day. And they have been for really the last week. Pardon me. So I was out this morning and digging up a few potatoes, and I'll prepare those for supper tonight. And I got a few onions, too. So got those in a 5-gallon bucket and brought those back. Checked the irrigation. I turned it on for the first time this season. Everything's looking good with the irrigation. No leaks, nothing like that. And everything that I planted is under irrigation. Sometimes I get excited and plant kind of a little too far out, maybe towards the road or towards the back creek. And they don't quite get the irrigation, so I'm down there with hooking it up to the faucet I have down there and dragging the hose. And that kind of defeats the purpose of having irrigation in your garden. So I made sure when I was planting this year that everything was going to be in under irrigation. I got to love it. So just go down there, flip a switch, and irrigate the garden. And hopefully we don't have to use it a lot. Hopefully God will provide us with the rain that we need this year for this beautiful garden, and we'll get lots of food for the family in the freezer. That's what it's all about. You can probably tell I'm not quite as loud and a little scratchy this morning. All the doctor visits last week obviously caught a cold from something or somebody. So, but I'm on the downfall now, and so I think yesterday was the big, heavy, irritable day that you have, so that's why there was no show yesterday. Had a pretty bad sore throat and drainage and all that kind of stuff, so there was no way I was going to be yapping and coughing the entire show. Just wasn't going to do it, and wouldn't have been fun for you nor me. So, but today, no problems. I'm on the downhill slope, so thankful for that, and hopefully Jen and Caleb and Lily won't get it, but I'm sure I got it at one of the doctor's offices I was visiting last week with Lily. So gotta love it. Let's see, update for the rest of the week. Of course, you know we've got Peter Brown, the chicken doctor, on today. Great topic. Tomorrow we've got Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine. He's going to be joining us tomorrow talking about herbs. All kinds of herbs, how to store herbs, how to grow herbs, the whole nine yards. So you're not going to want to miss tomorrow's show. It's going to be a humdinger with the publisher of Back Home Magazine, Richard Frudenberger, talking all about herbs. Looking over to next week, it looks like, hey, little man. Hey, how you doing? Yeah, truck. That's a truck. Come give Daddy five. The little whisperer just came in. He's probably headed to the kitchen with Mama to make some lunch. All right, bye-bye. Bye-bye. What, you want to go see Daddy? Okay. Give me five. All right, thank you. Who's Daddy's boy?
Yay!
Yay, you did it. Is that your train? Huh, you made a train? Ch-ch-ch. Oh, my goodness, he's growing up so fast. Gotta love it, the little whisperer. So go make lunch with Mama, okay? Okay? So you want to stay with Daddy? Okay, you can stay with Daddy. You can stay with Daddy. Come on up here on the couch. Rawr, there you go, big guy. There you go. All righty. So so next week looks like we got Monday. Peter Brown, the chicken doctor, will be joining us. Tuesday, the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy. Looks like Wednesday we'll have GardenWise Living with Arlena. Thursday, let's see, is scheduled for, Thursday, that's the third. So that would be the Dr. Bridget McRae, PhD, poultry scientist, next Thursday, and then a fun Friday next Friday. So we're going to see about that. Next Friday show may not take place. We may be on the road, but we got a full week next week. I'm really excited about that. Peter Brown, Monday. American Livestock Breeds Conservancy, Tuesday. We got. Huh? No, yeah, that's a clock. Good boy. And so packed full next week. Really looking forward to that. Gotta love it. You can tune in and hear not just me yap, but you hear the experts in their field share knowledge about our backyard chickens. So, gotta love it. Clean the coops. Let's see. I guess it was yesterday. Yeah, coops. Clean the coops yesterday. And, of course, we had a great day a couple of weeks ago. We processed 16 broilers that we had. And got those processed and in the freezer. I know several of our listeners. Huh? No, not cereal. In the freezer. In the freezer. No, you had cereal already. You already had cereal, so he's my co-host today, and so, but that was a treat, and we got those processed. Yep, a treat, and we actually had our big cast iron pot. I mean, the thing must be about 15 gallons, and a cauldron, I guess they call it, cast iron, and under open flame, and that provided our scalding hot water. It's okay, go with Mommy. I'll see you in a little bit, buddy. Oh, and here he comes. He just wants to be with Daddy. Are you Daddy deprived today? Are you Daddy deprived? So there we go. Back on off of mute here. So we got those processed, and boy, we got chicken. They were big broilers too. And not this, oh my gosh, big drumsticks are great. And as always, before we process them, we say a little prayer. We thank God for the humane treatment, of course, of the animals, and that they're feeding our family and giving us nutrition and the whole nine yards. So it's not just this big Neanderthal type of kill, but we do say a prayer before we start and thank the good Lord for the chickens that are feeding our family. A good, nutritious feed or food. Not the mass-produced stuff, and they had a good life to boot before they were sacrificed to feed our family. So, but we did that, and we put the garden in all in one day. Boy, that was a long day. It was probably a 10-hour day full of work, but it was well worth it. We had a great day that day working here on the homestead. So I hope your gardens are going in. I know there's still probably some snow on the ground somewhere. And 16 chickens. Let's see, how long did it take? Christmas Chick was asking in the chat room, do you want to know how long it took with setup and breakdown, or just once we had everything set up, the actual processing? I put myself on mute so you wouldn't have to worry about it. Well, I do not have a plucker, or a picker, they call it down here in the South. They don't call it plucking chickens. They call it picking them. Or at least a lot of locals do. So let's see. I had some help, and for time issue, I guess a total of everything was about 2 hours. That setup and breakdown and everything, and putting them in the freezer bags, and we got some jumbo bags. Didn't really need them that big. I thought I was going to do whole chickens, but we did not. One of my helpers, she was great, actually cut everything into pieces. So I got the legs. So anyway, what I did was I put basically two chickens in each bag. I figure when I go to the freezer, if I'm taking out chicken, I'll take two chickens worth out, and then we'll, you know, have chicken casserole or fried chicken or chicken nuggets or, you know, baked chicken or whatever the case may be over a period of 10 days or so. So, but that was everything. That was basically getting the big cast iron pot out, starting the fire underneath that, bringing the water up to a boil. And then getting the tables out, Cloroxing the tables, Cloroxing all the tools, getting our 5-gallon buckets out that we rinse, that we dip. And the way we did it was we would go over to the pot. We didn't actually dip the chickens in the cast iron pot. We had that pot, which was our consistent boiling water. And then we dropped a 5-gallon food grade bucket that had been Cloroxed into that. Brought it up to the processing tables, and then that's where we actually dipped the chickens to help the feathers release, if you're asking. Kind of how we did this along the way. We had the chickens, the tables in an L shape, and one table was for the picking of the chickens or the plucking, and then the other tables was for actually the cutting and the gutting and whatnot like that. And then at the end of the table, we had a bucket sterilized, well, Cloroxed, with clean water in it that I replaced about every time we did two chickens. And so we had that bucket of water that we got, the hot water from the fire where the cast iron was. And so even though we've done shows on processing here several times with Dr. McRae and whatnot, but we didn't use the killing cones. I got the killing cones. We didn't do that. We just basically do the old-fashioned country way where you go out and just basically wring their necks. I know y'all got pet chickens, and so do I. There's chickens that we have named that I wouldn't do this to. That's why we keep it separate. So we've got our eaten chickens that Jen doesn't get attached to that aren't named whatsoever, unless you want to name them teriyaki or something. And then you've got your pet chickens or your layers that you don't. So anyway, just make that very clear, because we know some of you are vegetarians and vegans and don't like to talk about this, but the majority of our listeners have no problems with it. So We use that one table to pluck and clean them up. I don't have a plucker. Boy, I wish I did. That's the most time-consuming thing. And then once they were all plucked, they were set on the second table. And then that's when we do the actual processing. And then at the end of that table, once they were cut into parts, legs, thighs, breast, wings, then I would take them and we'd dip them in that clean water. Once I'd done that, put it in the Ziploc bag, and then we'd go and put them in the freezer. And we actually had some this week. We had both. We had some fried chicken. We fried up some chicken because I made those biscuits whatever day it was this past week on the radio show. Jen wanted some fried chicken to go with it, so we did that. So we had some fried chicken, and it was very, very, very good. She said some of the best she's ever tasted. So about 2 hours from setup to breakdown, re-cleaning everything after we were done, 2 hours, 16 chickens. And we actually had, there were three of us that were working that. So not too bad at all. And then after that, we got the garden in. So got to love it. So just since you were asking, I know that you process chickens down there on, let's see, Poets, what we used to call it, flicking chickens. Flicking as in plucking, you know, pluck the chickens. They call it picking chickens down here. Y'all call it flicking. But I would love to have a plucker, either one of those fancy whiz-bang pluckers or one of the ones that kind of looks like a washing machine tub with all the rubber fingers in it. And you just place the chicken in there in a matter of seconds, literally 20 seconds, 15 seconds, it's plucked. I mean, pin, feathers, and all. Because that's really the most time-consuming thing. Maybe I'll have to do that. Maybe I'll have to start contacting some of these manufacturers of these chicken pluckers, and maybe I can do a swap for advertising for product. So we'll have to see. If maybe we can do that. And cool. How old were they? They were 10 weeks old, and they were. They were a Cornish cross that we got from Mount Healthy Hatcheries. And we've done the Heritage Meat Birds before. And but I knew that Lily was on the way. And so I think we got them about 2 weeks before Lily was born. And so they were actually about 10 weeks old, I believe. And they probably could have been processed at 8 weeks. But I was busy on the road, if you remember. So we came back for 3 days. I didn't really feel like doing it then. And then we went on our trip, and then we came back. So they probably were large enough, and to my satisfaction anyway, at about 8 weeks. But we waited until 10 weeks, mainly just because of our schedule. I would have done them at 8 weeks if I had had the time and had been home. But we waited until 10 weeks just because of our schedule. And they were good, good size, no problems. So that was just us. And the Isa Browns are doing well. We cleaned the coops and got them. Got looking forward to some additional fresh farm eggs this August. They should start laying. Isa Browns, we really love that sex-linked breed. We got our first ones back in 2008, and they were fabulous. So we got some more. I think that we got them the week Lily actually was born. So they're about eight weeks now. And there wasn't a huge difference, Misty, between eight weeks and 10 weeks. A lot of times what people will do, depending on what meat bird breed you have, is they'll withdraw or withhold rather some feed, because those Cornish cross, those broilers, they will eat and drink and eat. As long as it's there, they're going to do it. And so to prevent them from actually having the health issues, the leg issues, the heart attack issues, and things like that. Because all they're going to do is eat. Because a lot of times you can just withhold the feed for, instead of have food there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you can just have feed during the day and not feed at night, or vice versa, however you want to do it. So a lot of times they'll feed 12 hours on and then 12 hours off, and then still... And then still have, of course, 24 hours a day water for them. But you just pull their feed half and half, 12 hours feed, and then pull the feed out of the coop for 12 hours. And then that way they're still getting plenty of nutrition to be a good, healthy bird, but they're just not gorging themselves and getting so big and fat they got issues and just want to sit there. So there's ways you can do that. So there was not a not a significant difference really between 8 weeks and 10 weeks because we did that. And they weren't too big. We couldn't handle them. They weren't too big, that the meat was tough by any means or anything like that. So it was a good experience. And too bad Caleb was napping. Sorry about that. Had to wet my whistle. I didn't want to cough in your ear. And so with this little cold I got, obviously, from visiting they don't eat much at night anyhow. And this is, of course, light. If you keep light in the coop, like the Tysons do and a lot of the Purdue's and things like that around here, you'll go, and they got light 24 hours a day. They're eating 24-7. They're drinking 24-7. It's crazy. That's why in 5 weeks they're going to slaughter. 5 weeks. 38 days, something like that. They're going from the time they deliver the baby chicks to the time they're coming to collect them to take them to processing around here, these big commercial farms. We're looking at 5 weeks, 36 days, 38 days, something like that, and which is amazing because there's a big commercial farm down the road with Tyson. They got their baby chicks the same week I got mine, the broilers, and I remember when they came in to collect them to take them to processing. And I was like, holy cow. And I looked at mine, and I was like, man, mine aren't even ready. I mean, I guess if you wanted a small, skinny run of a chicken, but, I mean, they're not ready. So you go by, the lights are on at midnight, 2 a.m., 3 a.m., food, water, everything. And pretty crazy to have them ready in 38 days. So my goodness. I don't know the mortality rate at the Tyson. Down there. So, and it's interesting because you mentioned that poet. You remember, you're in the show enough that back when I was doing Pasty Butt with mine, you know, I had a guy that works with the family that own those houses down there. And I was doing Pasty Butt for my chickens, and I'm like, you know, how many chickens do you have in that house? What, 30,000? 40,000? And I said, what do you do about Pasty Butt? Because I know you're not going to actually go in and check Pasty Butt on 30,000 birds. He's like, nope. My job is to, every morning at 7 a.m., 8 a.m., every morning I'll walk through the houses and pick up the dead birds and put them in a 5-gallon bucket. So that's what part of his job was. And so it wasn't to check for Pasty Butt to prevent that. It was just to walk through the houses every day at 7, 8 a.m. and pick up the dead chicks from Pasty Butt or whatever the case may be. And I couldn't tell you how many. I guess I could go undercover with one of my farmhands and see and say, hey, do me a favor. Every day when you're down there, count how many you get out of each house, or just do one house and see how many. I'm sure Tyson can probably tell you that, because the just like Peter Brown says, let's switch over here and see. Yeah, he's called in. Just like he says, and he has a good point, sick birds don't pay the bills, and dead birds don't pay the bills. Tyson doesn't make a dime on those dead chickens that Phillips collecting every morning. They don't want any more sick birds or dead birds than they have to, because that's money they ain't making. Dead birds don't pay the bills. And I'll quote Peter Brown with that. And so, but I guess based on labor, paying somebody $8 an hour to sit in there all day and look for Pasty Butt is not going to make up the difference, I guess, between the number of birds that die from Pasty Butt or disease or from cannibalism or whatever when you're dealing with 40,000. So, but we've had a fun time here on the homestead with the chickens and the garden and things like that, and I hope you are too. to wherever you're at across America and your homestead. So we thank you very much for tuning in today. So thanks for the questions about processing. Glad you were interested. Glad I could share it with you. And it was a very enjoyable time. We had a good time processing our birds last week. So let's head over to the phone lines right now, and we're going to bring on our good friend, Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor. Peter, welcome to the show.
Hey, Andy.
Isn't that right? Yeah, I think I quoted you correctly there. Dead birds, sick birds, don't pay the bills.
Either way, there's no profit in them, that's for sure.
No profit, sick or especially dead birds.
Especially the dead ones. And if there was a profit in those dead ones, Tyson would have somebody out there and Purdue would have somebody out there collecting them, but that's not going to be the case. And it makes sense, exactly what you're saying. But I will say this, and again, I'm not trying to defend them. I believe I'm being just fair all the way around. They're built into they would love to have every chick they put in that chicken house come out on the other end as meat. That's the whole game, but they know that's not going to happen. And the way they judged whether they're going to do anything else to the flock at all, medicate it or move it or market it early or whatever that case may be, is all predicated on mortality rates. And I'm not sure today what the mortality rate is, but I can tell you one thing, I guess above 2%, somebody's going to be screaming at somebody.
Right.
And, they'll look at generally speaking, a service person will come to the farm once a week, as a general rule, and he'll come through, spend a little bit of time there. They do use some biosecurity there. When those fellows come, they have a disinfectant bucket. They will add disinfectant and water to it and clean their boots with a brush and that kind of thing. So there is something going on there. They do put coveralls on and those kinds of things. So because they go from farm to farm, and they could be the easiest spreader of disease. But that being said, they do that, and they go in and they check the temperature. They check the mortality. They check to make sure all the fans and the fan settings are okay, because see, here's part of the problem. If I want that chicken house at 72 degrees, the farmer might want it at 70 degrees, and he might move the thermostat around and that kind of stuff. So they'll check all those things. They'll check to see that the fans are working. In the summertime, if it's really hot out, they'll check to make sure that, the misting system is up and working and all those kinds of things, because it's to their advantage to do so. And they hold the grower responsible, because technically the grower owns the house, and not even technically, he owns the house and the property, they own the birds. So it's kind of a rental agreement. They're renting space on his property and his chicken house, but those chicken houses are built and maintained to the specifications that either Purdue, Tyson, or one of the other big outfits puts forth. So if they say it's going to be 72 degrees in there and that's how the fans are going to be set, that's the way it's going to go. And so none of that stuff will be changed.
Who pays for the food? Does Tyson pay for that food, or does the farmer?
No, it goes against the flock cost, but it's all provided, mixed, formulated, and stuff by Tyson and or Purdue or anybody that does an integrated operation. Integrated operation just means that they do everything. They don't go outside of the complex itself to buy anything. I mean, I live not too far from Purdue's main office and their main feed mill and office complex, and where they keep all the the soybeans and corn, and it's a huge, huge complex. And It just boggles the mind some days that you could think that they could get enough corn and soybeans all in one spot, enough trucks and stuff to haul it off all over God's green acre here, and because each feed bin holds 20 tons of feed. So if you've got 4, 5, 6 houses on it, it means he's coming back to your place more than once.
Yeah, they have a big mill right down the road here. And it is amazing to see the trucks lined up, bringing in, taking out, and whatnot. But I knew it was their blend. I just didn't know how all of that works. So the farmer down here, he owns, obviously, that's his farm. His house is there, and he builds those coops. He owns those houses, and then Tyson provides the chicks, and I'm guessing the litter, or the shavings and the feed. So he's just basically providing the housing and labor to take care of them.
Yeah, and then you know they'll provide the medication. They may have a place for him to go to get it.
Right.
They tell him to go to a particular supplier where they have an account, and then he'll give his flock number or grower number and sign for it and that kind of thing. And so the way it works, basically, it's real pretty simple. They know up front how much feed should go through that flock. In other words, they have a good idea, a very very good idea, how much feed will go through that particular flock. So they already know what the upfront costs as a baseline are going to be. So that's a parameter that is set. If you produce a flock that has mortality under a certain percentage, if its feed conversion rate is a particular low feed conversion, and all of these things, then that's how they're rated. So let's say 10 people are going to 10 flocks are going to market this week. Out of all of the week's flocks that go to market, there'll be a number one and a number 10, and you'll be paid accordingly. The guy at number one gets more money than the guy at number 10. There's a base amount that they have to pay you, and nobody wants to be there. Everybody wants to be above that base amount because that's how you make your actual real profit on these things. Nobody wants to watch these chickens for nothing, not if they got any sense in their head, but... So if you have a flock that's got high mortality, it's going to be difficult for you to be up to top. So it would behoove you to be a real good steward of those birds. Three things when you're raising birds commercially like that, and even in a backyard setting, you know, food, water, and air. Those three things are critical. Birds that are even in a backyard setting that never get out of the coop, never get outside and get any real fresh air and everything else, generally never do as well as birds that run around. It just isn't. And those that don't get enough food, don't get enough clean, good drinking water, just don't thrive as a general rule as well as some of the other flocks of birds that are out and about every day. The biggest problem we all know with free-range birds is predation, you know, hawks and God only knows what else out there. So, they don't have that particular problem. But so then that grower will be based on how much medication was used, what his feed conversion ratio was, whether it was within tolerance or below tolerance or above tolerance, and all of that will play out at the end of the day. And then they get a score, and then the guy at the top gets the most money, and then it trickles down to the bottom. The guy at the bottom might get just above the base amount or whatever. If you're really bad, you know, flock after flock, then they'll do like a good NFL team or any football team would do. They'll cut you. They'll drop you like a hot rock.
Right, right.
You know, and because you're not profitable. Something's going on in that particular farm. And sometimes it's their fault, meaning Purdue or Tyson with crappy quality chicks or some project that they're trying out that isn't working out the way they expected it to be. Unless that mortality is off the wall, there's no compensation to the grower at all. He'll fall in line just where everything else. And therein lies the rub with a lot of these people doing this. Here where I am now, we have a large influx of Koreans and Oriental people either buying farms or managing these farms these days. A lot of the people that, you know, the old-timers that are here, they're retiring and stuff, getting out of it. You had mentioned that, 30, 40, 50,000. I dare say you won't find too many houses here that don't have less than 100,000 chickens in them now.
Right.
You know, they're just huge, huge chicken houses. And by and large, they do a good job. Think about it this way. Nobody wants them to be sick, Purdue, Tyson, or anybody. If you've got any common sense about you. We all know that, you know, like I say, I coined that phrase, dead birds don't pay bills. I don't care who you are. And medication is expensive. They don't want to medicate them willy-nilly. And some of them here are getting away from it. They're trying to go to some more of these more organic-type things to try to keep the disease under control as far as that's concerned. I know Purdue is making a big break away from a lot of that stuff. We're trying to help people do it the same way with the oil of oregano, which is working out pretty well for those that have been out there now that have tried it. So, you know, it just depends. And, you know, some people think it's cruel to keep them that way, but I dare say everybody could feed their family out of their backyard because most people today aren't going to do it. The people who are out there today who are doing it, you know, I applaud them. Yet you're going to go out and you're going to raise chickens or whatever it is, even if you've got a real good-sized garden and feeding your family in from it. I'm all for it. I think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. But to ask the whole nation to do that, I don't think it's going to happen. And a lot of people be starving to death, trust me.
No, I agree. Every time we have a garden, and I'm putting in my garden, even though we've had some pretty good success down here, it's like, man, if I had to rely on only what I grew on our current homestead, we'd starve to death.
Yeah, and it's that way because of the fact, for the most part now families are a little bit larger for the most part, and those kinds of things. Everybody's crazy lifestyle, running 900 miles an hour to get nowhere.
Yeah.
We were all part of that. I was part of that too up until a year or so ago, it affects everybody differently, So I applaud those that have the gumption and the wherewithal to do it and stick by it and stick by their convictions for it because it's not easy. And then, again, there are those people that have been doing it all their life and love it and wouldn't do anything else. So that's a commendable thing, no question about it. Before we get started, unless you've got something else, before we get started on these two things, last time we had the show on, we spoke about incubation. And I wanted to bring that up just momentarily here again this morning because I did have someone that was having some difficulty hatching some eggs. And I just, again, I don't usually read stuff, but this is the answer that I put out. And this was embryo mortality out around, they didn't give a specific day, seemed to be the information that I had was the yolk was not fully taken into the body. So that would tell you that it was somewhere, it happened somewhere around or before the 19th day, because 19th day is basically right in that time frame where the yolk is going to be taken into the to the body. This could be humidity too high, too low. It could be the vitality of the breeding stock, meaning that there was a deficiency somewhere as far as the vitamins, minerals, amino acids, and that kind of thing, which then is held over to the offspring in the embryo form, and the embryos just don't do good. They're weak and can't make it out of the shell and that kind of thing. So. I was under the impression, though, that one of them did make it through. So if we started looking at it, we start narrowing it down to, what happens at each day of incubation. We start to look at this thing. I was estimating from just the information that I had, and I'll just read briefly what I said. I said, if the yolk is still outside the body, it would indicate death was prior to 19 days. And we talked about this last week. We talked about, the importance of breaking the eggs out each time they don't hatch for whatever reason, making notes, taking pictures, all those kinds of things. Anything you can do, you're like Inspector Clouseau here. You're trying to find out what's wrong. The only way you're going to find out what's wrong is if you know what you're looking at. So that's why we went to the extent, last week of trying to explain all of that. And I realize it's difficult without pictures, but if you can get the point of it. So then I said, if the small intestine was outside, but the was inside rather, but the yolk was still outside the body, that would mean that the death took place after 15 days of incubation, but before 19 days when the yolk would be in the body. So we can narrow it down. We can say that based on these two parameters, if we took these eggs and we broke them out, we would know that this mortality was happening between 15 and 19 days. It generally wouldn't be happening later. Because the yolk would be retained by the embryo at that point, and then by further examination of the egg, another tip off as to whether this could have been too much humidity or not enough would be by the 16th day. So we start now to break it down. We want to find out what happened between 15 and 19 if we can. So we start to then look at the 16th day of incubation, which would tell you that there would be very little albumin left in that egg, okay? Because it's at the 16th day that there is very little left, and the yolk is getting ready to be retained by the bird because that's going to be its next source of real nutrition, okay?
Okay.
you know, and I said to, you know, take a look at the position of the embryo, make sure that the head is under the right wing, that the head is still in the large end of the egg. You could also take a look to see if the membrane was breached at the large end of the egg. That would tell you that probably happened later, closer to the 19-20 day period of time. So I just was trying to give somebody, the fact that preparation for hatching then would take place around the 17th day, and that's where the head would start to be turned to the right and under the right wing. So if that's all in place, then we know that the 15th, 16th, 17th day probably didn't happen in there. So now we're narrowing it down to something happened between that 18th and 19th day, and I would certainly look at this being right off the bat being an incubation problem, either too hot, too cold, either too high humidity, probably lean on the humidity more so than anything else. I was told that in the email to me that the temperature was stable. So bearing that in mind, we're starting to look at something happening to this bird the 19th day, right in there. Actually, it was more than one embryo; it was several. So, because when the yolk is absorbed into the body cavity, then between the 19th day, by the 20th day, the actual pulmonary respiration starts. That's where you would look for the breaking of the air cell, and the allantoic respiration and circulation. They stop altogether. The allantois would dry up. So those kinds of things give you an idea as to, as close as you can, when mortality happened, and then you have to decide, and again, this goes back to what I said, keeping good records every day, staying on top of that humidity. You can't just say, well, it's always been good, and I've always done it this way. That's when stuff falls apart, and you never find out what's going on, and you keep hatching eggs, and you have this unnecessary and unwanted mortality. This could be also, again, going back and look at low vitality in the chicks, it could have been eggs that were held too long and then incubated. I didn't have any answers to that part of it, but I wanted to share that with everybody. That just happened this morning, prior to this show, all I said that I checked the incubation humidity, see where that goes, and I said as well that egg breakout is critical in fixing this particular problem, and I think anybody knows anything about it, what we talked about, especially last week, that would certainly be the answer here. So
great information.
Yeah, it just plays on me. Anytime I get something good like that people can really sink their teeth into, because to me that's important. You can take, if you have it in front of you, you can see what's there and you can make some deductions from it. And if you think that your incubation was correct, if you kept good records and you say, hey, I turned them, my humidity was good, my temperature was good, none of that ever faltered, then you have to start going back and saying, okay, it's not me. Again, we said incubation was part art, part science. The science has all been figured out for you. The art of getting a good, strong hatch basically lies with the operator. So then I would probably go back and start taking a look at the breeder flock and looking at some supplementation and stuff like that. And I'm a big fan of the supplementation of breeders. Again, we've talked about how important it is to do that and what a monumental undertaking it is to lay an egg in the first place. So I would, again, I'm a big fan of supplements. And again, I'm not hawking my own stuff. Use whatever you darn well please. You know that. But certain things I know and we know from doing this show that do work. I would consider putting those in the breeder stock water for the first 10 to 14 days before you even put them together, then put them together in about 3 days a week after that. And I think you see a lot of this stuff just stop as long as the mechanical end of the incubation is kept up and so on. But I just thought we'd share that today and put out more information that you really can't get anywhere else, and that's why we do what we do. And these other two subjects, God Almighty, we've talked them both to death. I am back at it again with them to dispel some rumors that have been around on some of the boards. Don't particularly care to necessarily say where. It's not important. But I wanted to talk, I think, first about coccidiosis. And this particular disease is, in my opinion, I have another story to share with you this, that happened this morning, but to me, it's the number one killer of birds. It's the most misunderstood disease that there is, and there really isn't any need for that. I mean, I've written about it a number of times. There's a number of people who have taken my information with or without my permission and put it up on their websites, and that's fine. It gets around, and we're still battling this same thing of not understanding how birds acquire immunity to this, and the fact that, well, I'm using a medicated feed, and, you know, it can't be coccidiosis. Well, that's not all of that's true and not true. It just depends. And so, you know, well, some comments were being made on one of the boards. One of the comments was that, you know, mature birds don't get coccidiosis. And there's another fallacy, you know. And then trying to quote some stuff from another website from one of the universities and the fact of saying that, you know, they said that, you know, by such and such a week, birds will, you know, have immunity. That can only be afforded to the birds if they were probably immunized in the first place. So you have to understand, number one, what you're reading. If you're not smart enough to understand what you're reading, then I guess maybe that's how some of this stuff gets around. But you take that to heart, you know, as being the gospel on it, and it's the information they were giving you was in saying that a bird that is mature should be immunized to coccidia if the bird was properly immunized, if the bird was properly immunized to the strains of coccidia that it's being exposed to present day. Having been exposed to 2 or 3 out of the possible 9 and then being exposed to 6 others later on is going to give you coccidiosis no matter what. No matter what you used when they grew up as babies, no matter how well you did it. And generally, you don't know whether you're immunized well against coccidiosis till there's some sort of a challenge, some sort of exposure. Bringing in another bird from another farm that where people claim they've never had coccidiosis because they don't know what it is, they don't recognize it, birds are dead, they just bury them and they go on. I mean, I had an experienced individual call me this morning, and this is the God's honest truth, strike me dead right here in my chair where I'm sitting. But can't raise a bird, can't raise one. So we went through it line by line. How come? What's the problem? And the problem is you can't raise birds on wire very effectively and get good immunization to coccidiosis. They need access to their own droppings in order to get that immunity. And I don't care. It's just the way it is. Constant re-exposure of the bird to droppings that are infected with the coccidia that are on that particular facility will impart immunity to those birds to that particular strain of coccidia, whether it be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different strains. But not allowing that to happen, you don't know where you are. This individual this morning called me and had a brooder about 3 feet wide, about 8 feet long, which I think was a little bit too big for 15 birds, and they all died, every one of them. Every one of them. Typical coccidiosis, about 10 days they started dying, right up through 14 days, and by the time 14 days came, there wasn't one left. Now, it wasn't a ton of birds, but still, no, it's all that effort wasted. And for a few measly dollars, this whole thing could have been done. Using medicated starter. Well, I'm using medicated starter. I said, yeah, but they don't have access to their droppings. They're crapping it out on the ground, going through the wire, making it easy for you, but very tough on the bird. So I wanted to go through this and re-explain the position on that. Yes, birds properly immunized for the strains of coccidia that they are exposed to will gain immunity. That immunity will not be maintained unless they are routinely and continuously re-exposed to those particular strains of coccidia. It's that simple. When you go and look at the commercial poultry industry, what we just talked about, when I say commercial, I'm talking about broilers, they don't want coccidiosis in these birds, period. And they don't use the same things as a general rule that we use in the backyard setting or the fancy setting, okay? They use a type of medicated feed that you do not have access to, okay, predominantly for the cost, and it doesn't impart any immunity to bird, prevents it, period. Period. They just don't get coccidiosis. Although there's some breakthroughs now. Some of these things are not working because they've been used forever and ever and ever, and they're starting to have the same problem. Right now, I still sell it, but can't get it. Coccidiosis vaccine. Ain't a bottle to be had. Not one. And for the first time ever, I had some stuff that was getting close to expiration, and the person said, I'll take it. Most of the time, I end up throwing it away because there's none to be had. And why is that? That's because the commercial poultry industry is having so much trouble controlling it with right. the types of that they're using that they're now turning to this because they do have access to their droppings. And right in that vaccine, they'll tell you the birds, in order to maintain immunity, must have access to those droppings. And it's critical. You know, look, I don't pretend to be right in everything when people call me and say something about this, that, and the other thing. I'd say the majority of the time we're right because people call me back and tell me. But, you know, you have to recognize this stuff for what it is. And the commercial poultry industry, to try to save cost, be about 2 weeks or so, just depends, before the birds go to market, they'll pull their coccidiostat. That's a habit they've gotten into over the years to save money because it's that expensive. And they'll go and put Amprol in that feed, or they'll put nothing in it because, see, it takes 7 days for the oocysts that cause coccidiosis to get rocking and rolling in the bird system. So if I'm going to market in 7 days and I pull it today, it should be good that we get to market or close to it. If not, they come back in with Amprol at a higher dose and put it on those birds and try to control it that way. Even that's not working that well. Amprol has been overused because it was one of the main coccidiostats that was out there. If you go back and look at coccidial history, you'll look at one of the main ones that was taken off the market now in most places, which was the arsenic products, okay, the 3-nitro, roxasone. And it was the original coccidiostat, basically, until they decided and found out there were more strains of coccidia than it was able to control. And technically, if you go back and really look at the literature on Amprol, it was really only going to take care of Emeria tenella, which is a fecal tonsil type of coccidia. It did fairly decent against the others, but it didn't really hold everything in check like it did. So it doesn't surprise me, nor does it really surprise anybody else that knows anything about this stuff, that it falters. And that's where we come in with some people like Solmet, which I don't like for various reasons. But I happen to like the sulfadimethoxine, and I like to rotate those two around. If it's done properly, birds should be immunized, and you should be able to knock off any kind of anti-coccidial medication by the time the birds are 16 to 18 weeks of age, and then go on it after that on what we call an as-needed basis. If it shows its ugly head, you pick out the Amprol and you hit them with it, knock it back down, and you should be good to go. But and also, you know, keeping them in sloppy conditions, moisture and heat with this particular disease are your worst enemy. This type of wet bedding and the heat that's produced by the droppings just makes it so that these oocysts that are causing the coccidia grow very prolific, grow crazy, and the moisture and the heat, the hotter it is down there, they just love it and they just keep growing. And the birds digging around in the litter and that kind of thing, makes their exposure that much more. Andy, it's a little after 1 on mine. Did you want to stop there and take your?
That's fine.
If you want to do that, you can do that, and I'll get a drink while we're.
Okay, sounds like a plan. We're talking with Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor. Pardon me. Lots of great topics today. We had that great information about incubation, a follow-up from the last few episodes, which was wonderful information. Now we're talking about coccidiosis and then CRD. So stay with us. Lots more information coming up right after this short break from our sponsors.
When you need an incubator, think Brensea, the incubation specialist. Grency has been a world-leading manufacturer of incubators for over 30 years. Incubators from 7 to 380 eggs with high-quality electronic and digital controls, including precise humidity control and programmable egg turning, all at surprisingly affordable prices. Visit them online at Grency.com. Grency spelled B-R-I-N-S-E-A. That's Grency.com or call 1-888-667-7009. Enter the coupon code WHISPER at checkout and save 10% on their incubators, brooders, egg handlers, and other incubation accessories. When you need an incubator, think Grency. Technology you can trust.
Pictures of chickens on aprons are common across America, but picture a chicken wearing an apron and you'll probably get a good chuckle. Laugh if you must, but nothing protects hens better than the Hen Saver Hen Apron. Hen Saver Hen Aprons protect your hens from the damage caused by an overly affectionate rooster and may even provide protection from an unexpected hawk attack. Hen Savers come in several different sizes to fit both bantam and standard-sized hens and roosters. Colors include camo, denim, navy, brown, khaki or black, and soon pink. Crazy K Farm is expanding its already colorful Hen Saver collection to include the color pink. A portion of their sales will be donated to organizations that fund breast cancer research and awareness. Order your Hen Saver aprons today at hensaver.com. That's hensaver.com.
Mount Healthy Hatcheries has been a hatching tradition for over 80 years. Home of the healthiest chicks, Mount Healthy Hatcheries offers a wide selection of bantams, turkeys, guineas, ducks, pheasants, and of course, meat birds and layers. Order online at mounthealthy.com, that's mthealthy.com, or give them a call at 1-800-451-5603. Don't forget to ask about their free bonus chicks offer. Mount Healthy Hatcheries, home of the healthiest chicks.
Today's special guest segment is brought to you by NatureWise Natural Poultry Feeds by Nutrina. NatureWise Natural Poultry Feeds by Nutrina are the natural choice for nutritionally balanced feed for your flock and contain only fresh, wholesome ingredients. Learn more at NutrinaNatureWise.com. That's NutrinaNatureWise.com.
How would you like a punch in the beak?
This looks like a job for
Super Chicken.
You get the super sauce. I'll don my super suit.
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, special Thursday edition of Ask the Chicken Doctor with Peter Brown. Talked a little bit about incubation with a follow-up earlier in the show, and then talking about coccidiosis now, and we'll follow with CRD to wrap up the show. So let me click this button here, and we'll bring Peter back on live. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, this. So I just wanted to, you know, to go over this just a little bit. You know, just try to hopefully dispel some of the rumors, misinformation that is out there, because just because you're giving them medicated feed and you don't have an outbreak of coccidiosis when they're young doesn't mean it can't happen later. It does. It happens all the time. And you know, the things to take away from this, from my perspective, is that coccidiosis protection is not lifelong unless the birds are continually exposed to the same species of coccidia that they were immunized against. It's quite simple. And I think we've said this before in previous shows as well. If I took some birds from your premise, Andy, and I don't know whether you treat anything for coccidiosis at all, or you feed medicated feed in the beginning. I never have asked you at all. Don't really, you don't need to say anything. But I took some birds from you. Let's assume that you treated, and I took those birds, and they had two or three different strains of coccidia that I didn't have. And I just quarantined them, and they looked good. And after 30 days or so, I stressed them, and they looked good. And I just put them in with my birds. Well, and then my birds start getting sick, start getting dumpy looking like coccidiosis and the symptoms of coccidiosis and so on. And, you know, you'd be running around scratching your head trying to figure out, you know, why. My birds didn't have this problem before, so now why? Well, the only game changer was introducing your birds, and unbeknownst to most people that if yours had those couple of strains that mine didn't have, now after a while in the litter they're starting to spread this all around, and my birds are getting blown out of the water.
Right.
And that's exactly how it works. I mean, it's and each one of these species of coccidia lives in a different area of the intestine. For those who would, you know, it's basically done for scientific purposes. Nobody really cares. The type you have, whether it's Tenella, Nacatrix, Acervulina, Brunetti, which are the nastiest ones that are out there, basically, it doesn't matter which one you have. If you've got coccidiosis, it's a problem. It needs to be addressed, immediately. So, that's one of the things that has to be, you know, be taken into consideration there. The other thing I want to say is no argument with anybody about Ampryl and Corid being the same.
Right.
It tickles me no end. I want to laugh and roll around on the floor when people tell me, oh, I got to have Corid. The Ampryl won't work. And I can't understand that because it comes from the same manufacturer. It all comes out of the same plant. It's all, whether it's powder or liquid, it's all the same strength. It has all the same active ingredient in it, made the same way. The only difference between the two is the labeling. Ampryl is labeled for chickens, and Corid is labeled for cattle. And I think sometimes it's psychosomatic. I think people have been using this product for so long that they're not able to recognize that the one and the other is the same and wouldn't want to venture out for fear of the Ampryl not working. But by and large, they are the same thing. And if you are in a pinch and you can only get Corid, go with it. If you can only get Ampryl, go with it. Doesn't really matter, either one. If I was in a pinch and Solmet was all I could get, I'd get the smallest amount I could because you have to try to mitigate your circumstances and get things under control. But I definitely would not use it any kind of long term as part of my program ever. It's just not a product that lends itself very well. And I know there are people out there saying, nah, he's full of baloney. Well, it's okay. But just ask Dr. McCray. She knows. She's seen it firsthand. She had a couple of folks, more than a couple from what I understand, a while back that just who administered the product correctly and everything else and just unbelievable kidney damage and so on. It was miserable and killed a lot of good birds for no reason at all. So the other thing to take away from this, too, is that vitamin E supplemented in the water has been shown to help shorten the course of a coccidiosis outbreak. And very shortly, we will have that up on the website. We do have a supplier with a water-soluble one that will break down in water, even though it's a fat-soluble vitamin. And we're working out the directions and everything as we speak. And that stuff is inbound, should be in here tomorrow, Monday. And as soon as I can get it up on the website, I will do so. So that kind of, I don't know if there's any questions about that particular subject, but...
Nope, all's good.
Okay, so real quick, I'll just go over what the symptoms would be. And they're very dramatic once it starts to appear. The biggest thing is your birds can look good today and they can really look bad tomorrow. In a couple of days, they can be dead. If the birds are feathered out, we start to see ruffled feathers. They puff up. The feathers look unkept. They're droopy. They may droop their wings. And then you can be confused with with Marex. The tip off there would be that you're really not getting any of the real crippling that we see. But they may droop one or both wings. Sleepy. Falling asleep, standing up, become very, very lethargic. Most of us know that when you're raising biddies, they run here, they run there, and they're all around. And when they're not sleeping and stuff, so reluctance to move. If you put your hand in in a brooder, as a general rule, they'll start to move away from you or run and flap their wings or do whatever. These birds won't move. And very lethargic, reluctant to move even when you push them along a little bit. They may move a few steps, but they'll stand right there. And, some may show an incoordinated gait, meaning that they might stagger a little bit and that kind of thing. We see it from time to time when they act like they might try to step over something. It's not one of the most prevalent ones, but we do see it. Last but not least, you may or may not, depending on the species of coccidia, see blood in the droppings. One of the other things that generally is observed later is just prior to death, when you pick them up, they've lost tremendous amounts of weight. They're all skin and bone. So those are the kind of things that we see with coccidiosis. I want to run back over it again, only because I felt it was important.
Yeah.
Never hurts to be reminded about something that can be so devastating to a person's program. You spend all your time and money buying good breeding stock, putting them together, collecting good, nice hatching eggs, and keeping everything going the way you want to, and you get a nice hatch and you get some good, healthy-looking birds, only to have them die on you is not fun. So from my perspective anyway. So keeping the litter dry and keeping the caked-up litter from getting around the feeder, waterers, that kind of thing will go a long way to helping you overcome this disease or even maybe keep it off of your doorstep as far as that's concerned. We'll move on to what's generally known out there as CRD, which is actually more than one disease within itself. True CRD is Mycoplasma gallisepticum, or for short called MG, generally complicated with E. coli. That would be a true case of chronic respiratory disease, or CRD. Symptoms can be from practically nothing, birds that don't thrive very well, to birds that have severe respiratory issues, may or may not have some swelling in the face. There's a term out there where it was for many years and still by some continues to be called bubble eye. And that partially comes about because they have a tendency to foam in the corner of the eyes. There'll be some foaming and so on. Coughing, choking, labored breathing, all of these things can indicate that you have a problem with CRD or even just plain mycoplasma for that matter. If you had just the MG by itself, it's a case of mycoplasmosis. If you had the E. coli by itself, and it's limited to the air sacs, then you have a case of air sacculitis. The disease is a worldwide disease everywhere. There are flocks of birds all over that are free of it. The commercial poultry industry, for the most part, is free of it. As far as the breeding stock is concerned, the broiler industry is pretty much free of it. They don't generally have a problem with it. They eliminated it quite a few years ago through breeding and testing and eliminating the carriers and that kind of thing. So the disease is a bit of a sleeper disease, and by that I mean it doesn't show itself until birds are generally stressed. You could have an active case in your breeding flock, knowing for sure through blood tests or whatever that the birds are under an active infection, and you would take those eggs from those birds and you would hatch them out, and the offspring would be tested at day one, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, and they're all negative. And then something happens in their life, a crisis, no feed, no water, predation within the flock itself, picking, all these kinds of things, change in weather, thunderstorms, too cold, too hot, too wet, too damp, all of these things, or any combination of can certainly bring it out. And then we start to see the symptoms of the snotty nose, which they generally don't have as much as some other diseases would have. There may be some eye involvement and these kinds of things with this particular disease. We've been over this numerous times, so I'm not going to go into every little detail of it. but I wanted to explain that it does not live very well outside the bird's body. So when we start talking about mycoplasma and we look at it something that's moving relatively quickly through a flock, we don't necessarily rule out mycoplasma, but we don't put it on the front burner. It's not the first thing I'm going to be thinking about. A lot of folks don't have, and even if they did have access to a laboratory, don't want to use it for obvious reasons. Governmental intervention in some states can be fairly harsh. If you were down in the Carolinas, North Carolina, where they've got a lot of turkeys and stuff, if your birds are positive for mycoplasma, they're going to go to a great chicken house in the sky real quick. Mycoplasma, the MG, is extremely harmful to turkeys and has caused many deaths in turkeys over the years. So they're going to protect their poultry industry down there. And if you've got birds that are positive for MG, I don't know down there now if they'll let you at least keep them, but you can't sell them, you can't move them, you can't do anything. And if you get caught doing so, even selling eggs from them and that kind of thing, I think you're going to be in trouble. Eggs for eating purposes only would be okay because there's no harm to any human with the organism whatsoever. But like I said, some people, you know, there is a test available for it. There are many tests available. The plate agglutination test basically is one that is used as a screening device. Because some of the other tests are too expensive, like PCR testing. I think a lot of the PCR testing is up in about the $65, $75 per bird range as far as testing is concerned. And most state laboratories, especially now with the economic conditions the way they are in most states, they're not going to run those tests on any of your birds, for that matter. They're probably going to do a plate agglutination test, which is a serum blood test rather than a whole blood test. If anybody's familiar with the Pelorum test, Pelorum is a whole blood test where, and it's a plate agglutination test where they're going to take the blood as it comes out of the bird, and they're going to put it on a piece of plate glass, and then they're going to put a drop of the Pelorum antigen with that. They're going to mix it around. They're going to rotate it back and forth in their hands and read it after about 3 minutes. If it looks like it's full of sand, that's what they call agglutination. Clumping, then it would be indicate a positive test. If it looks like two liquids pretty much mixed together, that would be a negative test. And the mycoplasma and the Pelorum test will read the same way, but they're basically done the same way, except that this one, the mycoplasma is on the blood serum. So you have to draw about a half a cc, at least of blood from the bird. And let it coagulate in a syringe. So if you were doing it, you would take the syringe and pull the stopper out so that the blood in the syringe is not very deep. You don't want it thick. The thinner it is, the quicker and easier the serum will separate out from the blood. So you have a blood clot surrounded with an amber-colored fluid if you've done it right. And it's a drop of that amber-colored fluid and the mycoplasmal antigen that you'll mix together in the same fashion that you mixed the Pelorum together, and you'll rotate the plate for 3 minutes and read it. It reads the same way. If it looks like sandy and clumpy, it's positive. If not, it's negative. So there is a test that people can do, and I would encourage people to who think they have a flock that is positive and that wants to know to do this. I used to sell the antigen, but I wasn't a big seller, and to sit around here and get outdated, and it was relatively, for me anyway, to have sitting on the shelf and have to throw it out at about $100 in that range. But you can buy it from Charles River Laboratories out of Massachusetts. If you Google that, you'll be able to find it real quick. Just tell me what the mycoplasma plate test antigen, and give me your credit card and stuff, and they'll send it to you. And it should come with some directions on how to do that. Anybody that wants to do it, I don't know when I'll have it ready, but we're working on it's probably going to be a CD of some sort to show you how to do it. But it's a little ways off. I've got some of the material together, but too many irons in the fire at this point for me. And I've got some other things around here got to get done before that. But anyway, the list grows on and on.
Oh, yeah.
But a lot of people ask me, what do I mean by mycoplasmal, okay? What that really means is this bacteria. It means really two things. Maybe not so important to most people, but what it means is that it's extremely small in size, okay, which is not a big deal. But this is the thing that is important, and that means is that it has no cell wall. And when it doesn't have a cell wall, it makes it more vulnerable to disinfection, to the elements, and all of these kinds of things. So when you have the mycoplasmal deal going on and the bird is shedding that through droppings, mucus, any fluids coming out of the nose and or the eyes or anything like that, it doesn't live very well outside. That's why it doesn't spread. I was talking about that earlier. I said how something spreads can be the biggest tip-off as to whether you decide you're looking at something viral or you're looking at something bacterial. If you can't decide, treat it with an antibiotic. If they really respond to it, you can almost rule out the viral things because it wouldn't respond so well. It might respond a little bit if there's a secondary bacterial infection. Okay. So the antibiotic would be working on the secondary bacterial infection, but the virus would be still going on its own. Whereas if you had a bacterial infection and used an antibiotic such as Oxitet or something like that and you saw an immediate response, you'd pretty much know that you're onto a bacterial thing. Trying to figure out which one, if it's real important to you, you're probably going to have to run a test of some sort to find out exactly. But you can make some educated guesses. On the bacterial side, if you're trying to decide this one, the mycoplasma would spread very slowly, the MG, whereas coryza would spread pretty quickly. Okay, and the reason that the mycoplasma doesn't live so well outside the bird's body is because it's host-dependent. Having no cell wall certainly helps. Its inability to live outside of the bird's body. But this is a bacteria that, when we say host-dependent, what that means is that it's highly adapted itself to the avian species, chickens, okay? And they have a relatively small genome, these mycoplasma do. And all that means to you is that's all the inheritable traits that an organism has. So it can't make these factors that it needs, these complex compounds that it needs to maintain itself by itself. It needs a host in order to take them from that and biosynthesize them in the host and keep the organism going. I know it's a little complicated, but it's kind of like trying to make Andy, you were making biscuits the other day. It's pretty hard to, you take your egg and you put it in, if you're using eggs, you put it in your biscuits, but if you haven't got any water, you're not going very far. You know, it's kind of like the same thing. So that would be, it would be the same thing. If this thing needs water and it can't get it, it's going to die. Well, it's got a double whammy. It's host adapted, so it lives well inside the bird, but not outside because things that it needs to survive nutritionally, I guess is the easiest way to explain that to you. So they get those things that they need from the host, which would be the chicken. But outside the bird's body, they don't have access to that anymore, so now they're more vulnerable. If they don't get them in a short period of time, they die. And if the sun is out and in full force, they die. If it's too cold, they die. If it's too hot, they die. If it's direct sunlight, they die. If you're running around squirting everything with disinfector oxine, they're going to die very quickly compared to others that have a cell wall. Or even maybe encapsulated. Some have a cell, other bacteria have a cell wall, but then have a capsule around that, which makes it even harder for medications to work for some other ones. But by and large, that's the deal on this particular disease, CRD. I brought it up because several people have brought it up online, different places. Again, not any one group that I want to point to. Somebody had taken some birds to a laboratory, and again, I don't think they understood what the laboratory was talking about. Telling you to give the bird Tylan and then to give it bacitracin, there must have been something else going on. And my guess is because I didn't see that paperwork and didn't ask for it and wasn't privy to it. I ignored it. No sense in having a fist fight over something you can't win. But that bacitracin would never, ever in 100 million years work against the CRD organism, because the claim to fame of neomycin and or bacitracin, they're two separate antibiotics, but neither one of them migrates out of the gut. That's their home. That's where they work. That's where they do their job, and they never leave home. Okay? They're not like Carl Malden, who took his American Express card with him. They stayed home, and they stayed right there in the gut. So there must have been a gut issue going on with these birds, which may have in turn triggered the mycoplasma, or the mycoplasma was not even a factor, okay, and the gut issue was a factor, because that when they did the blood tests on these birds, they picked it up. Now, again, I wasn't privy to all of the little details, but saying on a board that they had the same problem as somebody else, they did not, in my opinion, from the information that was exposed. So that's why I wanted to bring this up. This doesn't live well outside the body. It's a devastating disease when you do get it. It's very readily and the majority of the time, the preponderance of the time, it is passed on to offspring through the egg. Okay, from infected breeding stock who have an active infection going on at the time of conception. So, but the largest percentage is through the egg. A minimal amount is through bird-to-bird contact and that kind of thing. You would pretty much, if it was being excreted in the droppings, another bird would have to come along for the most part within 20 minutes to a half an hour and consume a reasonable amount of that dropping in order to become infected on its own. So it's much more difficult outside the body than it is through the hatching egg. Very readily done through the hatching egg, very well documented. The information, and I gave some information out on it last time about the different times for inanimate objects, all came from the experts, Dr. Glisson and Clevin, down at the University of Georgia. They're the world experts in this particular subject, and I've been doing it for many, many, many years. And the information that they, that organization down there had put out, where had they done all the testing of the mycoplasmal organism, put out on a hay bale, put out on shavings, put out on concrete, asphalt, you name it, piece of wood, whatever, just didn't live very long. And most of it, most of the time, if my memory serves me correctly, somewhere between a half hour and 45 minutes tops, all by itself, you know, just out in the atmosphere. So it doesn't spread very well. Again, very tough to get rid of. And one of the reasons that this disease is tough to get rid of is because of where it lives. Okay, it lives on the what we call the upper epithelial surface tissues of the bird's respiratory system, meaning the lining, upper level lining, the very top lining of the trachea, the upper parts of the lungs, and the surface of the air sac. So you can see the difficulty in getting the, you know, medication to these particular places in quantities sufficient and sustainable over a period of time, not just a one-time deal. Getting that medication there consistently in quantities that are going to kill off the organism and render the bird free of it. It can be done. The only product that I've ever seen being able to actually do it was Baytril, but it was given for a long, long period of time, well over 30 days. And the cost of doing so is cost prohibitive. It used to be a little bit, a little bit less expensive. Years back, when Bayer put out a Baytril in a liquid form, and then the commercial poultry industry ruined that, and the government took it off the market because of increasing antibiotic resistance in Campylobacter and uncooked chicken, or poorly cooked chicken. So we lost a good medication that was available at that point in time. This can be spread by free-flying birds. That's been documented. Chickens, turkeys, pheasants, Japanese quail, bobwhite quail, peafowl. There has been some isolation from some ducks and geese. You should have seen birds, parrots, parakeets, macaws. Been isolated from pigeons. Some of these have their own strain, which is not necessarily so infective to chickens. It's a disease that's out there, and I see more and more of it these days. So I want to clear up a few things about this and give people a heads up on it. Be extremely careful when you buy birds from people. I said this time in and time out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you're made arrangements to buy birds from somebody and you ride by there, do your drive-by, please, please. And I know it sounds stupid coming from a guy that sells you the stuff to help fix them, but that's not what it's about. You want to get the best bang you can for your buck. You don't want to bring home the Trojan horse, I can tell you that. And there's enough people around that have those stories to share. And it can be devastating to a flock and your pocketbook as well. And, you know, nobody likes to have to put their birds down. But if you're in the wrong state, and some of these states are tightening up now, I don't know if it's true. I saw something on the Internet the other day somewhere about Texas now passing, getting ready to pass or has passed or doing something about animal identification that's going to entail chickens and stuff. I mean, you know, here we go. We're going to try to keep track of chickens. We can't keep track of humans. I mean, duh.
Right.
It's foolish, but it's driven by the commercial poultry industry, I can tell you that. And it's not going to help one bit. It makes more criminals out of people than it does anything
yep.
else.
Cause yep.
Nobody wants to adhere to it. Nobody wants the government telling them what to do. But that's part of the problem we've got these days. So.
Yeah, I was a big advocate against the national identification, the NA, National Animal Identification System.
Yeah.
And and made my thoughts and opinions very, very clear to USDA. And the very first time they came out with it, they did table it for a while. And then it came back maybe about a year ago, labeled something else. And mm-hmm. it's still somewhat tabled at the national level. But you're saying that Texas has come out with something at the state ag level?
From what I read, I don't read every bit of the thing. I read a couple of the headlines on it and people hawking it on, I think it was on Facebook where I actually saw it. But I will tell you this, you know, I know people and have dealt with people over the years who had game chickens, and not condoning, just, I don't care whose chickens they are, chickens are chickens to me, so I don't, that's not my gig. But they sat around for years, and their mantra was, it's my right, it's my right. And today, they don't have that right. It's a felony to move a chicken across state lines for the purposes of fighting. Don't have to be even caught fighting them. Not now. If you've got chickens in your car and they're trimmed, you're done. And that's it. And even in one of the strongest states in the country, two of the strongest states in the country, three of them, Arizona, Oklahoma, and Louisiana. And short order, gone, done. And if you think that they're not going to implement this thing little by little, see, and they can't get it done at the federal level. They can't get it done countrywide all at one time. So they're going to nickel dime this thing to death. And what they'll do is they come in through the back door and they'll give states the money to do this animal identification thing. And That's how it'll get done. And so while you're sleeping, you know, this thing will be imposed upon you, like it or not. And that's the way it'll go. And I only use the other as an example because they sat on their hands and didn't want to do anything either. I'm glad that they don't have that right. That's not the issue for me, though. Okay. But I am against the animal identification thing. I mean, look, let's control the borders first, and let's figure out who the heck's here first before we find out how many chickens you got in your backyard. And you know, it's not going to stop anything. It's not going to stop avian influenza. It's not going to make the response any quicker. It's going to drive people underground just like it has in game chickens and everything else, because that's what it's done. drives them underground.
Let me tell you this, not really related to chickens, and we'll wrap up the show of you talking about that and the national notification and things like that. Yesterday, it was late afternoon, and we were going to go see some neighbors last night, and so I said, well, I'll take a pie or a cake. I didn't have time to make anything. So I drove 8 miles, 9 miles down the road, and we live in East Bumble, just in the middle of nowhere, thank goodness, love it, and went to the little Piggly Wiggly, okay, in the middle of nowhere. 89th poorest county in the nation. Oh, no, I'm sorry, we moved up. We're the 61st. 61st poorest county in the nation. And so I walk into this little Piggly Wiggly, and I go to the frozen food section, and I get a I don't know what kind, a key lime pie. We'll take with us to be good guests. And I get up to the register, and I noticed about a month ago they upgraded to these fancy type of computer style registers, and there's actually a small, probably 19-inch computer screen right there, pretty eye level. You can see the weather radar while you're having your groceries rung up, things like that. And I never noticed. Yeah, it's kind of crazy here in middle of nowhere, Piggly Wiggly. But I would have never known this till yesterday, and I swiped my card, and it's a debit. And you can use it as debit or credit, and we don't own any credit cards. So I swiped it, pressed credit, because it normally, anyway, for my own personal reasons, and then pressed credit, signed my name, and the lady there went over to move that monitor towards me and says, it wants to take your picture, so let me move this over a little bit. And I said, what the hell are you talking about? Take my picture. She says, it takes a picture of everybody that uses a credit card or writes a check. And I said, automatically. And she says, yeah. So if you would not have told me that and moved the monitor towards me so I was in view of that little digital camera, it would have automatically taken a picture of me. I would have never been notified. I would have never had any information on it at all and walked out the door. And she was like, yeah. You would never know it was taking your picture. And I questioned her. I said, well, where does this picture go? Where is this picture stored? Where is it, how is it, is it cross-referenced? Does it now go to some federal database? Is it doing an eye scan? I just went off, on that kind of conspiracy theorist tangent. And I was like, so again, we have to give up our freedoms for security.
Yeah.
And so it was, yeah, I will never step foot in that Piggly Wiggly ever again. And I'll be writing the manager a letter there and calling the local newspaper, because I'm sure nobody knows. And a lot of people won't care, but I know a lot of people that will care and will stop shopping there if they're snapping our picture. I don't know where it's being sent, where it's kept, how long it's kept, what database it's been. Who knows? So
That's wild. I wouldn't stand for that either. I mean, it's sad enough every place you go there's a security camera going to take your picture somewhere to prove you were somewhere. But I mean, the police department has it now. I don't know if you've seen them, but they've got plenty of them here. And I've seen them in other small towns and stuff. And they've got two cameras, one on each fender of the back of the car. And he sits on the road, and he takes your plate number, reads your plate number as it comes down the road, and he runs your plate automatically, constantly.
Exactly. Instantly. Yep, absolutely.
So, I mean, as long as we all keep accepting it, every time we turn around, everything is accepted. I see all kinds of things going on, and there's only a handful of people really protesting it. That's the, if you are against the way we enforce the laws in this country as far as our borders are concerned, then maybe the preponderance of people need to do something about it. But the preponderance of people don't even vote. So
right.
This kind of tells me that the majority of people don't give a rat's butt one way or another. I got my own way of thinking about these things, as you well know. And,
right, right.
But
it just, it amazed me. I mean, if I was back up in John's Creek, and I call it something different, but I won't say it on the radio show, I probably could expect it or, wouldn't have shocked me so much. But being here literally in the middle of nowhere, and they have this high-tech system that was extra shocking, that it was here of all places. Mm-hmm. And then the fact that I would have never known, how many other times I had been there, got my picture taken, and didn't even know it. what was not nothing posted, and when you walk in, they don't tell you. It's just absolutely nothing. So it is.
I wouldn't allow it either. I would have left everything right there and just walked out, not doing nothing.
I couldn't believe it. So just one of those things to. One of those things, and of course, a lot of people listening to the show, and I hear this, and this comment probably aggravates me more than anything, when they say, well, if you have nothing to hide, why does you care? If you're not breaking the law, why does it matter? If you have nothing to hide, why do you care? Oh, really? Why do you have blinds on your bedroom? Why do you have curtains on? Do you have curtains in your bedroom window? If you don't have anything to hide, why do you have curtains on your bedroom window or in the bathroom?
There, you know, I'll go along with what you're saying. There are certain things that, drug testing for a job, I don't care. That type of thing. But there are certain other things I wouldn't tolerate. I wouldn't tolerate somebody just taking my picture like that. No, I just wouldn't do that. I draw the line different places maybe than somebody else might. But, by the same token, we supposedly, I heard this on the radio the other day when I was doing some errands, and we're supposedly taking the fingerprint of everybody that leaves this country. They want to enhance that some more. I didn't realize we were doing that, but evidently it's not good enough. I look at it this way. You have a terrorist that bombed Boston here recently, and we couldn't even keep up with him. His mother was on a list, but he wasn't. How do you figure that?
Yeah, wasn't he interviewed, too, by the FBI a couple times?
More than once, yep. Didn't find anything to, the Russians pointed him out as somebody that should be watched, and, we didn't want to do that.
I got one more for you here. I just posted it probably 30 minutes ago on my Facebook page, and the title is Experts See Farming as Next Big Use for Drones. Okay, and this comes out of Washington. Yeah, it says, drones numbering in the tens of thousands will be in the skies by 2013, the Federal Aviation Administration predicts. But where some may fear precision weapons or flying spy cameras, Steve Markovsky sees flying tractors. Markovsky is a new business planner for Yamaha. He hopes to repeat the success here that the company has had in Japan with RMAX, an unmanned aerial vehicle that sprays fertilizer and herbicides over farms there. In Japan, the RMAX has more in common with a tractor than it does with a helicopter, said Marfarski, of the remote-controlled helicopter that has been used in that country for 2 decades. Agriculture is expected to be one of the biggest potential markets for drones in the U.S., as the FAA develops regulations to open the skies by 2015 and commercial uses grow for unarmed aerial vehicles, UAVs, or drones. And so there you go.
Only in America. I'm telling you, sometimes I really, really wonder where we're going. So.
Let me give you an example here. Let me scroll down here. Okay. Robert Blair, an Idaho wheat farmer, started looking into unmanned aircraft as a surveying solution in 2006 after he spent $9,000 on a single manned aircraft flight and then waiting weeks to get the data. After some experimentation with a kit, he decided to build his own. The result is a drone that weighs less than 10 pounds, has a 9-foot wingspan, and gives him timely information about disease, weeds, and water on his 1,500 acres that he could not otherwise get.
Hmm.
So there you have it. You can go read the rest of that at my Facebook page. But drones will be flying over our farms by the thousands by 2030, according to the FAA. So...
Well, we'll see, because we can't seem to control anything, so I don't know. Nothing would surprise me. I mean, it's not something that I would that I would discount. You know, I mean, it just is, and I think that most people these days, fear whatever the government might do or something like that. I don't believe in every little clandestine thing that comes up everywhere. Everybody's got a conspiracy theory, but some of them are probably valid. It's very interesting. There isn't any question about it. I don't have the answers for it.
There was a post in the chat room that says, "Oh goody, now I'll be outside shaking my fist as the drone goes over my house spraying the neighbor's potatoes instead of the crop duster." Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, no, blame it on the drone.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't know any better.
Somebody posted on my Facebook says, if that drone ever flies over my property, I'm shooting it down.
Well, I don't know. It's, like I said, crazy world we live in, and
one of those things. So, no, I just won't be going back to the Piggly Wiggly here, that's for sure.
I would not.
Lost my business, yeah.
Yeah, I would not do that myself. That's going a little bit much as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah,
Giving you the option, I mean, I'm assuming that that's their method of cutting down on credit card fraud.
Yeah, or bad checks.
Bad checks and that kind of thing, yeah.
I guess the $8 Mrs. Fields pies, I guess, are adding up. Hey, man, have a great day. And,
Sure.
We'll see you back here. Let me look at my calendar here. This coming Monday, the 13th. And are we going to do the crop or the...
I want to just hold off on that because I want to try to supply some pictures of what I've got done here. We're very close. The yard out there where this is being done, the inside part of it needs to be cleaned up, and it just hasn't been done yet. I don't want to present it the way it is, but the units themselves are all in place. I'm very, very close to actually having chickens in there, to be honest with you. So just a couple of things got to be done, and we'll be ready to roll, and that's that whole deal. So it's coming along pretty nice. And I'm
like
very...
an old commercial from the 80s, I will serve no wine before it's time.
under the conditions that I'm keeping here, having them in place where they shouldn't be, I want the minimum amount of disruption for everything. I'm good to go. I talked to my immediate neighbor. He said he could care less. So I don't think that that's a big deal. And everybody else around me that's close on the other side, I know them fairly well. None of us hang out, but, we talk now and then and, help each other out now and then, so that kind of thing, So
if they complain, you can always sneak into their house and put white toothpaste in between their Oreo cookies. And,
that would be funny.
Good, clean, neighborly fun. Taking out the white sugary filling and replacing it with some white toothpaste. And they'll never know until they bite down.
They'll never know until they bite down. I don't know. They get it up close to their nose, they'll know. Actually, we could take that a step further. See the deviant mind. See something that started? We could take that a little further, see? And we could change that and put a little cecal tonsil dropping in there. They stink real bad. We've changed that. Just tell them it's a new chocolate Oreo.
There was a book that I'll admit I actually owned. It was back around 95, so it was many years ago, 15, 20 years ago. And you can probably Google it or go to Amazon and find it. And I think it was called Getting Even or The Art of Getting Even or something like that. And I can't even remember most of the things that were in there, a fun thing. But one thing was like if you go to your neighbor's house or go to a dinner party or something, and I think one of the things was to drop a chicken leg into the toilet tank, in the toilet. And then they just, what's the smell? Just little things like that, immature, what have you. But it was called, some of them were pretty pretty not very up and up. But there were some things kind of childish like that in there. But I think it's called Getting Even. And There's a couple of books out there like that. I don't know whatever happened to that thing, but it was interesting while we're talking about that. But, hey, thanks for coming on, and we'll see you Monday, this coming Monday the 13th, and we'll see you then. Thanks for all the great info.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Hey, have a good one. All righty, that's Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor. Visit him online at firststatevetsupply.com. That's firststatevetsupply.com. And if they don't have it, you don't need it. But great information. You don't get that anywhere. Not on these blogs, not on these forums, nowhere. Just right here on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. Tomorrow, great show. We've got the publisher of Back Home Magazine, Richard Frutenberger, is going to be here. We're talking all about herbs tomorrow. Do you have an herb garden? I don't do herbs. Maybe I should, but I just don't have them. I don't have an herb garden. I've got the big veggie garden, but I don't have the herb garden. Maybe that's something I can look into, because apparently it's pretty easy to grow herbs, and you don't need a lot of space to grow herbs. But it's just something I've never done. But tomorrow, Richard Frutenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine, all about herbs. So I hope you can tune in tomorrow, 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Until then, God bless everybody.